recording. Counsel ready to proceed?
We are, Your Honor, I believe.
I haven't been in this position since moot court in law school, so you have to bear with me. May it please the court, I'm Gunnar Shule, appearing on behalf of Gunnar Shule Jr., the defendant and appellate in this matter. Before discussing what I believe to be the critical issue in the case, I would like to note, as I'm sure the court is aware, that the Court of Appeals decision in the State of Hawaii versus MITA, which is attached as Appendix A to the opening brief, which was the basis for the first error raised at trial as to the sufficiency of the charge, has been reversed by the Supreme Court. And the decision dated December 10, 2010. Our Supreme Court distinguished the charge in MITA from its holding in State versus Wheeler, 121 Hawaii 383. But I have to admit, it takes a smarter lawyer than me to understand the distinction. And I'm not that versed in criminal law. I've read a lot of leases.
Are you conceding that I think it's we pronounce it MITA.
MITA.
That case has effectively made your argument
No, Your Honor. I'm not making any concession on that. I just don't want to spend a lot of time on it. The court can, I think the record is clear, the court can sort that out. I would like to say that if State v. Wheeler is good law, then the oral charge in this case does use terms that are not self-explanatory. And under the State v. Wheeler rationale, I think the oral charge would not be sufficient. And I'll touch on the self-explanatory nature shortly. But my real argument is really a construction of the statute itself. I think it had three elements, and trial court just disregarded one element completely. The instant case arises under Section 7-4-2, Revised Ordinance of the City and County of Honolulu, entitled The Strays Prohibited. This is commonly known as the leash law. And Section 7.4-2 states, it shall be unlawful for the owner of any dog, whether such dog is licensed or not, to permit such dog to become a stray. The defendant was cited under the lease law ordinance for a violation 6:30 p.m. on August 13, 2009. At trial, the defendant admitted that he was an owner of two dogs that were on a public street without a leash on August 13, 2009. This is significant for a couple of reasons, but in any event, in the answering brief, the state incorrectly argues that the defendant did not stipulate to the ownership of the dogs. And I'd like to just read a short portion from the state's brief on page 12 and 13. In the instant case, while the defendant was willing to stipulate to the identity of the defendant and the dogs, and that on August 13, 2009, the date of the alleged violation by the defendant, the dogs were running at large off the property of the defendant. Okay, we stipulated to that. The evidence offered by the state's witnesses included information indispensable to proving the ownership of the dogs, an essential element of the violation. Defendant not only did not stipulate to this element initially, but later contested ownership of one of the animals involved. I submit that the state's allegation is a clear demonstration that the term owner is not self-explanatory, and even the state failed to appreciate the statutory meaning of owner.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this question. It seems like one of the disputes in the case is whether we characterize the charge against your client as a criminal charge versus a violation in terms of the mens rea requirement.
That is certainly an issue.
Now, in this case, it appears that the nature of the charge was such that there was no imprisonment that was a possible penalty for this offense.
It's a part of sequences of offenses,
right. But
and
the
third
penalty,
one would result in the
right.
in but, imprisonment.
But for his charge, which was one prior offense, he could not have been given imprisonment based upon a finding of the violation. So under our penal code, isn't that the definition of whether it's a criminal offense or not, whether a criminal imprisonment is a potential penalty for the charge?
I think that imprisonment is part of the problem here, because this is just part of a series of cases, and so you have a statute and you apply it one way for the first two offenses, and then the third time when you get imprisonment, then it becomes you apply permit in another way and it becomes a mens rea offense.
But isn't that what the penal code says to do? In other
no.
words, the penal code says let me finish the question.
Yes, Your Honor.
The penal code has two provisions. One of which says that if it's a violation and it has no mental state, then you presume there's no mental state unless there's legislative history to the contrary. If it's viewed as a criminal offense, it's the reverse presumption. You presume that the default, even if the statute doesn't have a mental state in the statute, you assume that it's either reckless, knowing, or intentional, unless the legislature clearly indicated otherwise. So doesn't the structure of the penal code, in effect, apply to this statute?
Well, the structure of the penal code applies to the statute, and I could not find a case one way or the other as to where you have a series of violations. And and the third violation then becomes an imprisonment situation.
So your argument is that in the structure of this statute, even the first violation should be viewed as a criminal offense.
Right. I think each time you apply the statute, you need to have the same criteria, and you can't skip mens rea on the first two. That's still not critical to my argument.
All right.
Mens rea is not really what it's something that I brought up, and I think it applies. It's just like in Mita. I thought originally that was just low-hanging fruit, but it turned out to be so I had to raise it. But that's not my real argument in the case. The statute that defines owner means and includes every person owning, harboring, or keeping a dog, or having custody thereof. And on page 7 of the transcript, the defendant offered to admit that the dogs are kept in the household of the defendant, which is a clear admission of statutory ownership, which the state says we did not admit. I submit that we did admit in open court, and on page 8, counsel for the defendant, that's me, stated we're making the admission in open court.
Do you have a case that says that the court is required to accept the stipulation and prevent the state from putting on evidence proving it?
I do not have a case on that point, Your Honor.
I frankly thought
that was too obvious. So we conceded two of the three elements, which is owner, stray, and there's one left, permit.
All right, so what's your argument?
And so we should have, well, I'll get to that, but we should have since the case became a strict liability case as far as the prosecution and the court's concerned, we could have stopped right there after these admissions. But instead, we took testimony from two witnesses with respect to the identity of the owner, the identity of the dogs and whatnot, which are elements that we had already admitted. Despite the admission in open court that the defendant was the statutory owner of the dogs and that the dogs were strays, the trial court, over the objection of the defense, allowed the testimony from two witnesses, which testimony was offered to identify the defendant, which we conceded, as the owner of the dogs, which we conceded, and that the dogs were strayed on August 13, 2009. the prosecution then rested after the testimony of those two witnesses. The defense then brought a motion for acquittal on the grounds that no evidence was presented that the defense, quote, permitted the dogs to stray, which is required under the statute. The prosecution did not argue that any such evidence had been provided. And note that we made the motion orally and in writing, citing authority regarding the meaning of the term of permit and the applicability of the concept of strict liability where an ordinance requires permission. The prosecution responded simply asserting without citing any authority or commenting on the authority presented by the defendant that the violation was one of strict liability and that the trial court said that's correct.
Now, in cross-examination, you asked the witness, what did the defendant do? And I believe the response was, he was standing at the curb while the dogs were coming back, waiting for the dogs to come back.
Right.
Can you infer permission from that evidence?
You cannot.
Because?
We did put, when the court, after the court ruled on strict liability, the case is really over as far as the court and the prosecution are concerned, but we did put the defendant on the stand. And for the record, the defendant testified as to the steps that the defendant had taken prior to August 13, 2009, to fence the dogs into the defendant's yard, which the defendant testified had been fully effective. And the defendant further testified that he was at his office on August 13 when he learned that the dogs had escaped due to the defendant's son having left the gate open while taking the garbage out. So the defendant then, there was further testimony, the defendant came home the dogs came back. But you can't infer that the defendant gave any permission or permitted under the evidence before the court.
Mr. Schultz, the testimony of the two witnesses that the state proffered and the prior incidents of the dogs running about, I know you objected on the grounds that you had stipulated or conceded to ownership. Doesn't that testimony in some measure also go to inference of permission? In other words, if these dogs had in fact been straying before?
Well, that's what the state argued, but actually those prior incidents had nothing to do with the facts of what happened on August the 13th. And the testimony wasn't given with that in mind, and so I didn't really respond to it. It was pretty vague.
How do you establish that it wasn't given with that in mind?
It's in the record that they gave us that the prosecution gave us notice as to that they were going to have instances on prior incidents and whatnot to establish the identity and the ownership of the dog.
So referencing the specific proffer.
Right,
that was made.
Right.
And well, once the evidence is in, can't the court consider it for any proper purpose?
I suppose so, but the evidence shouldn't have been in the first place, and the court should disregard that evidence if it's,
As a matter of relevance, wouldn't the proclivity or the knowledge of a proclivity of your dogs to run from your property create a greater duty to take precautions to prevent that?
Well, we acknowledge that the defendant had a duty to do that. And if you look at the defendant's testimony, he spent a great deal of money to make sure those dogs did not escape. And the only way they did get out of that yard is through the inadvertence of the son, who was away at school at the time of the trial. But he left the gate ajar, taking the garbage out, and we really don't know the further facts, but the dogs escaped. But they were in a very secure place, and there's no evidence. All the evidence is that they were in a very secure place and that the defendant took reasonable efforts to make sure that they stayed in a secure place.
Counsel, on this occasion, once defendant found out that his dogs were outside of the fence or outside of his property, did he take any efforts or take any steps to retrieve the dogs?
Yes, Your Honor. He came home immediately. He came home, and after when he came home, he was outside, and the dogs were coming home almost simultaneously with his coming home from the office. But he came home from the office specifically because he got that call.
And the dogs came into the yard on their own.
Sure.
So you don't see any inconsistency between the neighbor's testimony, at least as to the end part of it, and your client's testimony about the dogs being, the neighbors testified the defendant was standing on the curb, appearing to wait for the dogs to come back. Your client's testimony was something to the effect of, by the time he got home, the dogs were already back on the property.
Well, I don't think there's any inconsistency. I didn't think that was that important a point, but the defendant comes home. He's told by the household what's happened. He goes outside, and the dogs are coming back. I mean, and he immediately puts them back into the fenced yard, and end of story. But he certainly didn't do anything improper, at least as far as the evidence is concerned before the court.
And there's no indication that the state disputed the defendant's version of
That's correct. The events. That's correct. The prosecution's position in the court ruling. I submit ignores the plain meaning of the word permit. In fact, they really give the term no meaning whatsoever.
Well, what's your definition of permit? For purposes of the statute,
it requires some action, and normally, at least negligence. The cases that I've cited and saw, you have to be bordering on reckless, and.
What about omissions?
Omissions.
Failure to act.
I think we covered that with the secure fencing testimony. So I.
In other words,
certainly.
Could you find permit based upon omissions, failures to act?
In the leash law cases, I really didn't. There's a reference in our brief to an ALR annotation with numerous cases as to an owner's liability for animals running at large. And without exception, the courts have held that where a statute provides that an owner shall not permit an animal to run at large, the statute is not violated without proof of at least negligence by the owner. And then if you read the cases, an analysis further shows that the negligence must be a culpable as opposed to just simple carelessness. And I could have cited a number of cases, but I just picked on one that's right on point. The city of Bexley versus Seltzer involves a leash law directly on point with the instant case, construing the language similar to the Honolulu ordinance. The Ohio appellate court held that an ordinance which made it illegal for a dog owner to permit a dog to leave the owner's premises without a leash did not impose strict liability, which is really the key. If you read the transcript, it's strict liability. And the court agreed. And the court held in city of Bexley that the evidence was insufficient to establish that the owner acted recklessly in allowing the dog to leave the owner's premises. Actually, I think there's no real point in continuing to belabor the issue. I think the cases are all similar to that, and I couldn't find one that I needed to distinguish. The state's answering brief, by the way, doesn't even attempt to explain or distinguish the established precedent regarding the meaning of permit and the application of strict liability on which the prosecution based its case at trial. In fact, the answering brief does not address strict liability issue. It doesn't even use the term. I'd like the court to note that the difference between two provisions of Chapter 7 of the Honolulu Revised Ordinance. If you look at the one on nuisance, Section 7-2-3, it provides it is unlawful to be the owner of an animal, farm animal, or poultry engaged in animal nuisance. Okay, under this ordinance as written, the actions or intent of the owner are not relevant. There's no permit there. The drafters of Section 7-4-2, which is the leash law at issue here, could have made the prohibition against strays a strict liability offense by simply stating it is unlawful to be the owner of a stray. But they put permit in to make it, okay. I'm repeating myself. The ordinance adds an additional critical element, which is in order to violate the ordinance, the owner must have permitted the dog to become a stray. At the conclusion of defendant's testimony concerning the steps taken to enclose the dogs and the defendant's absence from his home when the dogs escaped, the defense rested. The state repeated its argument that the offense was a strict liability offense. The defendant again argued that a violation of the ordinance required evidence that the defendant permitted the dog to escape. The court found that the defendant guilty, making it very clear that the stated element of the defense requiring that the owner permit the dog to become a stray was completely disregarded. If I might, I'd like to read the court's ruling, which makes this makes the court's holding very clear. This is on page 35 of the transcript. This is the court speaking. This is a violation and akin to infraction. And basically, the court finds that there is no specific mens rea required for this offense. The court finds that the state has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that these dogs were the property of the defendant, Edwin Gunnar Shule Jr., and these dogs were loose, off-leash, on a public street. The court therefore finds the defendant guilty as charged of this offense. The court just disregards permit. And so the word becomes meaningless under the state's theory and what the court did. There's a red light. In view of all of the points of error, I'm not conceding anything, Your Honor, at this stage, raised in the appellate's brief, but in particular the finding of a violation of the leash law in the absence of any evidence that the defendant permitted the dogs to stray on August 13, 2009, the judgment against defendant should be vacated and remanded to the trial court with instructions to dismiss with prejudice, and I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Ann Clark and I'm with the prosecuting attorney's office. And I wrote the brief that's been pretty well maligned here, unfortunately. And defendant's primary contention is that the absence of any action by defendant permitting the dogs to stray, that he had issue with the meaning of the verb to permit to being.
How do you define that term?
Well, the term is defined as permit. Black's Law Dictionary says to suffer, allow, consent to live, leave, or give license to acquiesce by failure to prevent. The regular Webster Dictionary also says is pretty much similar to that.
What evidence in the record is there that the defendant permitted his dogs to become stray?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's quite a bit of evidence in that regard, and I think it's on page 21 of the transcript where it made it pretty clear. Also, pages 15 and 16. If the court would give me permission to just read this portion of the transcript so that I don't get this wrong. Mr. Scholl, on cross-examination of his son, the defendant, it's actually Mr. Scholl cross-examining the complaining witness, Mr. Elke. And Mr. Scholl says, by the way, he reminds him he's under oath. You're under oath, by the way. Yes. You testified that on August 13th, in the late afternoon, you saw Mr. Scholl at the back door of his house. Answer, yes, also on the street. Question, and you saw him on the street. Answer, uh-huh. Question, and the dogs were where when you saw them? The dogs were on the public street of the Kahawalu Drive side. Question, and what did Mr. Scholl do? He was waiting there at the curb for the dogs to more or less come back to the house. There are no further questions after that, and no further questions of the next complaining witness either. Previous to that, on page 17, the same eyewitness noted that he saw another person talking with the defendant outside at the back door of the house and on the curb. I remember another fellow with a dog who also did not have a leash, and this fellow with his dog was coming up Ka'ohinani, at the same time as these two dogs came up there. I know that Mr. Scholl came to the back door of his residence and he exchanged a few words with this individual. So apparently the dogs were on the street. In the back, he was seeing them as the man with the dog came back, and the defendant was waiting on the street for the dogs to return. That's, Your Honor, why the state feels that there was a volitional act or a failure to act in permitting the dogs by a failure to prevent them from straying.
Ms. Clarkin, there's some testimony in the transcript about the dogs entering through the back door. Is that the back door of the property line, or is that the back door to the residence? You know, is there evidence as to what that back door refers to?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I believe in reading the transcripts, I believe that it wasn't the gate. I believe it's the back door to the residence. That's the impression that was given.
So at that point, obviously the dogs were on the property when the testimony is given about the dogs returning through the back door.
When the dogs returned through the back door, they were on the property. But previous to that, the eyewitness had seen, and this eyewitness was obviously, he's tracking the dogs for approximately 15 or 20 minutes. He had time to take pictures of the dogs outside. He actually cornered one dog, collared it, and took a picture with the dog.
It's sort of, though, kind of timing-wise, placing where Mr. Scholl is at the moment that, you know, the dogs are on the street, and so there's some reference, like I said, to a back door, and I just wanted to clarify.
Right,
was
there was
the
a back door.
Or the property line.
Right, and Mr. Scholl had actually testified that he was, the dogs had already returned by the time he got back to the residence.
Do you dispute that testimony?
I beg
your pardon? Does the state dispute that testimony?
No, Your Honor. The testimony of the eyewitnesses disputed that particular.
Mr. Scholl's testimony is that by the time he returns home from work, the dogs are already back on the property.
That's correct. And but the statement of the eyewitnesses and the evidence taken from that said that
he was
there.
It's ambiguous, right? The witness says the dogs return to the property, kind of on the property or on the street, at which point he then sees Mr. Scholl.
That page 16 and 17 kind of gives the impression, or one can reasonably infer, that Mr. Scholl was talking to the neighbor while the dogs were up on the street before they came onto the property.
But that wasn't the theory of the state's case below, right? The state's theory below was, if I prove he's the owner, the dogs were on the street, I win.
That's correct.
So there was no effort to actually link any activity, act or omission of Mr. Scholl and connect that with the dogs becoming strays.
Well, I believe that the prosecutor sat down after, didn't carry it further after hearing the admission that the defendant had
In other words, the court, the prosecution didn't focus on the permit requirement. They focused on the owner and the sure requirement of the statute.
That's correct.
And you're conceding now on appeal that permit is a conduct requirement or conduct element of the statute which the state has to prove.
Well, under Hawaii Revised Statute 702-200, subparagraph 1, penal liability arises from a voluntary act or a voluntary omission, the voluntary omission to perform an act of which a defendant is physically capable. In regards to this case...
Right, so what act did he fail to do that... It can't be just because the dogs are strays that that's enough to prove the case, can it?
I think that, under strict liability, it could if there's an owner.
Well, let me give you a hypothetical. I build a great fence that world-class, no dog can escape from. A burglar comes in, cuts a hole in my fence at night, dogs run loose. Am I in violation of the statute?
Under a strict liability reading, you are.
Under this statute, I permitted the dogs to run loose because a burglar came and cut a hole in my fence?
If I could just have a moment, Your Honor. Gives effect to all offenses defined by statute. Section 3 of that said the provisions of Chapter 701 through 706 of the Code are applicable to offenses defined by other statutes unless the Code provides otherwise. 702.212 provides that an offense which constitutes a violation, unless the state of mind requirement involved is included in the definition of the violation or alleged legislative purpose to impose such a requirement, plainly appears. Under this statute, that if you have a burglar cut a hole in your fence and let the dog out, and you own the dog and the dog is running at large, you're liable. But this isn't the facts of the instant case. In the instant case...
What would that be, though? In other words, permit, even if the statute doesn't require a mental state, it does require that the state proved that the defendant engaged in conduct, namely, he engaged in the conduct of permitting the dog to become a stray. So that's why I'm focused. I'm not focused on the mental state. I'm focused on the word permit, which is part of the statute.
Right, and permit means, as part of the definition, is a failure to prevent. So in other words, if you fail to prevent your dog from going out, and it happens often, such as apparently in this case by defendant's admission, the dogs are apparently escape artists, and according to this case, the evidence in this case is he spent approximately $70,000 doing this. Trying to keep the dogs in. He built a wire fence. He built a brick fence. He then put an electric fence in. He put an automatic gate in, but he never. I guess in Ina we do things differently. We go down to Home Depot and get a bag of cement and pour a hole, put a fence post, and put those dogs on chains. Or we lock the dogs in the house.
What if you did that and the dog escaped from the chain? Somebody came in and let some third party came in and unloosened the collar. Under your theory, the owner would still be liable.
Well, civil liabilities, strict liability in this case, Your Honor, is to protect the public. Usually, statutes protecting the public from harm and in this case, the neighbors and in any case where you have dogs running at large, the dogs are danger to the people in the neighborhood. They're a danger to themselves.
The statute really reads the word permit out of the statute. Your reading of the statute is the same as Mr. Scholl's argument, which is that the statute read, it shall be unlawful if any dog owner's dog becomes a stray. You don't need the word permit in the statute to impose that kind of strict liability, because you're saying that the the fact that a dog is a stray is enough to always prove that the owner permitted the dog to become a stray?
No, the permission element, I believe I understand what you're saying, I think. I think the permission element to permit is either a voluntary act. You let the dog out yourself, which did not occur in this case, or you fail to prevent the dog from becoming a stray, such as you sit at the corner and you talk, or you stand at the corner and talk with your neighbor and let the dog wander in the street, or you don't have a little sign on the back of your gate saying these dogs escape all the time. Be sure you lock the gate. Be sure you shut the gate. Be sure you shut the door. So it was defendant's failure to act in this case. He either didn't go out, and if you're standing at the street and the dogs are running down the street, you have a duty to not continue to permit them to be strays. You should go out and get the dogs. And this didn't happen in this case. And what the state is saying is that to permit can happen in two ways. And it's two ways, one by letting the dog out purposefully, or, you know, to go...
Okay, which is not, there's no evidence of that in this case.
There's no evidence in that in this right. case.
So we're focusing on the omission aspect of permit.
The
omission aspect
right,
of permit.
That's right.
Because there's no affirmative action to open the gate and let the dog out.
Well, we don't know, because nobody's seen
what's
happened.
There's no evidence of it.
There's no evidence. But there is evidence that defendant continued to let the dogs, to permit the dogs to wander when he was out on the curb waiting for the dogs to return, and the dogs were up the street.
Because why? What's the obligation of the defendant at that point?
I'd say the obligation of defendant is to get the dogs back immediately, not to sit and chat with his neighbor.
Is there evidence that the dogs were running on the road while the defendant was in their presence?
I think so. I think the thing that I read on the sixth...
That one question and answer is the entirety of the state's evidence on that point?
No, they had... there are also pictures admitted into evidence that the dog was running on the street, and other testimony from the defendant
right,
that he was...
There's no evidence of Mr. Shell's in the vicinity during that period of time, right?
During which period of time?
The time that the dogs were seen running on the street. In other words, the neighbor's testimony is, I see the dogs running on the street. We were standing 15 to 20 minutes. The dogs are in the neighbor's yard, some other yard. Eventually, they come back to the property. And at the point when they come back in the property is when the evidence shows that Mr. Shull is present. In other words, there's no clear testimony that Mr. Shull is standing there while the dogs are running up and down the street.
And a fellow with his dog was coming up the street, I mean Kahuinani, about the same time as these two dogs come up there. I know that because Mr. Shull came to the back door of his residence and he exchanged a few words with this individual. So to me, I believe that means that, you know, Mr. Shull was home. The dogs were not home at that time. Mr. Shull did not affirmatively act to go get the dogs. He was talking with his neighbor on the street, and that he failed to, he permitted the dogs to become strays by not going after them. Yeah. Is there any other aspect of this case that I can address for this court?
So your view of the statute is that first violation, absolute liability. Second violation, absolute liability. But the third violation would require proof of at least recklessness.
I'd say it's very similar to the DUI statute, Your Honor. And the DUI statute for first or second violations, for let's say the A2 or the A3, the blood or alcohol charge, strict liability. If you're driving drunk, you operate a vehicle, strict liability for blood alcohol over a certain percentage. This is similar if your dog escapes and strays. Strict liability for the first two counts. Now, if you are, say, a habitual offender and you drive drunk, what is it, third, fourth time, then it becomes, you have to, it's not strict liability anymore. You have to prove. You have to prove intent. And it's so with this statute as well.
So you, going back to this permission thing, so your view of it is that if a third, I have a gate that's secure, somebody, not me, opens, I own a dog, I built this fence with a gate so I can get into my property, somebody, not me, opens the gate, the dogs run out. I'm guilty of the, I committed the violation?
Well, this...
Yes, I committed the violation because I permitted the dog. I didn't put a padlock on the gate so that nobody else could open it.
Well, it's not necessarily the facts of this case. It's not evident that,
right,
that that's the case.
Giving
the hypothetical under strict liability theory, that would be correct if the first or second violation. On the third violation, it's another matter. However, we have evidence in the record, Your Honor, that clearly supports reasonable inference that defendant intentionally, if not knowingly, allowed these dogs to permitted to allow these dogs to roam. And whatever steps he took were not enough. He was aware of that. He rolled the dice every time he left
not,
for the
not
office.
On this occasion, though, right?
I beg your pardon?
Not on the charged occasion. You can't use a prior incident as proclivity evidence.
Well, actually, defendant testified to the proclivity of the dogs to roam and to, at every opportunity, that they'd go over the fence, they'd dig under the fence, they would escape previously, they'd escape in some manner means, and they had a proclivity to run through the neighborhood and into the forest preserve. Knowing that, defendant, every time he leaves for the office, you know, he was rolling the dice that the dogs would escape again. And if you're a neighbor with a five-year-old kid coming home from soccer or something, these dogs are out at large. The dogs are dangerous to the community. They're dangerous to...
No, but we can't use the fact that there might be evidence of prior occasions in which the defendant knowingly permitted the dogs to run loose to infer that on this occasion he did. Wouldn't that be the same as saying, well, because you robbed the bank twice this time, you must have robbed it the third time?
No, and I don't believe we're doing that. Defendant did
because that would be impermissible.
That's correct.
We couldn't do that.
That's correct.
All right. So how do the prior incidents prove the case in this incident, other than showing that there was knowledge that he's the owner of those dogs?
I don't believe that the prior cases had anything to do with it, otherwise, other than the fact that he's charged as a second offense. And that was a judicial notice of the previous case. This case had nothing to do. There was plenty of evidence on its own that defendant permitted these dogs to stray.
By the way, is there any legislative history on this particular stray dog provision? In other words, what did the the city council have in mind when they enacted this provision?
Your Honor, there's actually a real dearth of evidence here or testimony regarding it. It does show that in 1972, they changed it so that the dog wouldn't be. Previously, the dog was the one committing the offense. Apparently, they had problems with that, and Ms. Pamela Burns testified that they should change it to this, and it was changed to the owner permitting a dog to... become a stray. But other than that, there really is not a lot of evidence on the subject. Defendant noted two cases regarding the language of to permit, though I looked at those two cases. There were Alaska case, it was strict liability, but the strict liability was premised on a statute that did not cover the dog leash law, and they noted that in the statute. In Ohio, yes, there are two cases, and that Ohio case said what defendant said it did, but there are many, many other cases that are not, that are worded as similarly to the Hawaii statute.
So in terms of the statute, the ordinance itself, you're saying that there really is no elucidating legislative history that indicates what the city council was intending when they enacted this provision?
There is some language about, you know, the dogs running at large, but nothing.
Nothing specific about what they intended by the word permit.
No. Other than to change the existing law in 1972, apparently said that the dog committed the violation.
Hard to get the dog, prosecute the dog.
Apparently so, Your Honor. As before, I think there was sufficient evidence that the citation clarified the citation that said dog at large, dog running without restraint, together with the arraignment, gave defendant fair notice of what he should be prepared to meet, and took care of the essential elements. So barring any further questions, the state would rest at this time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, I think you used some of your rebuttal time, but you may have some.
Do I have any time?
How much time does he have left?
Actually, I really don't have much more to say. I just want to note that the ruling of the trial court that I read on page 35 makes it clear the court didn't consider any of this evidence of prior incidents in making its ruling. It just said,
I'm sorry. We're recording it, so.
Yeah. It was quite simple as far as the trial court was concerned. It was strict liability, and they found that the defendant was the owner of the dog, and the dogs were out, which we admitted. End of story. And so I think the state, and I didn't mean to malign the state's brief, but the state, I think, almost conceded in the brief that strict liability wasn't the applicable standard, and they didn't even argue it. You just can't get around, the meaning of permit, but the trial court just totally disregarded it. I think that was error. Whether any of my other points that I've raised in the brief are well taken, I'll leave that to the court to decide. But I, at the very least, I think that disregarding the plain wording of the ordinance is error. If there's nothing further, I'm making it right at 11.
Thank you very much. The court will take the case under advisement.